The House Human Service Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. We have a quorum, and Representative Knudsen read and would like to move the minutes for February 18th, 2025. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes from February 18th, 2025 are approved. Thank you for that, members. Members, today we have two reports that the Department of Human Services is going to be reviewing for us. We are going to begin with the PACE report, followed by the acute transitions report there. If it would be helpful, page 79 of the PACE report has an acronym list to help follow along as we go throughout the hearing here. So, without further ado, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your presentation.
Good morning, Chair Schumacher. Good morning, committee. My name is Natasha Mers, and I am the Assistant Commissioner for Aging and Disability Services at the Department of Human Services. Pleased to be here today to present two reports. We'll start with legislative reports. We'll start with Program of All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly, otherwise known as PACE. All right, so just a little bit of background information. PACE does have a history here in Minnesota. It was authorized, or this program was authorized at the federal level back in 1997. Minnesota took a run at it in 2010 and 11, but didn't ultimately get any bids for PACE providers at that time. But interest in this program, you know, has continued throughout since that time. So here today to present this legislative report, which also details the two different types of actuarial analyses and other types of implementation concerns. So I'll run through both of those at a really high level. Here's just a site for you, and if those links are live, if you want to go and actually review the report or see anything online. So I just wanted to have that there as a piece of reference. Okay, so what is PACE? PACE is a model or program of delivering home and community-based services for people age 55 and older. The goal of PACE is to keep seniors or people in that age bracket in their community through coordinated interdisciplinary care where services across both kind of Medicare and Medicaid are coordinated together. The important thing to know about being a person being eligible for PACE is that they must meet a nursing facility or a SNF level of care and be able to live safely in their home at the time of application to become a PACE enrollee. So when I say meets a nursing facility level of care, what that means is that a person would, if they didn't have services in the community, they would otherwise need to be in a nursing home to get their health and safety needs met. So we know there's certainly a lot of ways to meet complex needs in the community, and PACE is a model that integrates care across Medicare and Medicaid and delivering home and community-based services with the goal of keeping people out of institutional settings whenever possible. So again, keep walking through the PACE model here. You'll see that it really is an interdisciplinary model where there are many different professions and disciplines and helpers in a person's life. They're at the center of it, but they are going to have plans that are coordinated across the disciplines, PT, OT, nursing, primary care provider, and then home and community-based services. So what does PACE cover? All Medicare Parts A, inpatient, B, outpatient, the drug benefit, and also all medical assistance or home and community-based services. One of the things about PACE that is unique is that it does have kind of a geographic location in which that PACE provider is operating, and I'll go into that in a couple minutes. But PACE programs also have a site to provide adult day services. And adult day services are really a flexible service model where people can get a wide variety of needs met. They can get transportation to and from adult day. They can receive, you know, certain primary care services there, therapy, meals, and personal care assistance or baths on site. So that adult day center becomes kind of a hub for how people receive services if they're not receiving services in their home. So PACE is financed through a capitation rate. So a PACE provider receives a monthly Medicare and Medicaid capitation payment for each enrollee. And one of the reports that is associated with this presentation is the actuarial analysis. And so if you really are wanting to understand a high level of fiscal detail on how that operates, I would refer you to the actuarial analysis. So what happens is that capitation rate is set. CMS pays that rate. So CMS will actually cover the Medicare-covered portion, and then DHS, or the state Medicaid agency, pays for the Medicaid-covered services that the person is eligible for. Of note, that the PACE the federal requirement for PACE is that that capitation rate that gets paid per member has to be less than if the enrollee were not in the PACE program. So PACE can't result in more spending than Medicare or Medicaid would otherwise spend on that person were they not enrolled in PACE. I also want to point out for context here that often when, you know, their PACE is an integrated Medicare-Medicaid product, there are other types of integrated Medicare-Medicaid products, and we do see that in actuarial analyses, those numbers tend to look pretty similar. So Minnesota does have already a fully integrated managed care product for people 65 plus called MSHO, or Minnesota Senior Health Options. So I think it's helpful to know what Minnesota is offering today and how PACE might be different or additive to those current efforts. So as I just mentioned, we do have a fully integrated dual special needs plan called MSHO, and that is for people that are 65 and older, and that program covers Medicare Parts A and B and those that are eligible for Medicaid. And so MSHO combines the Medicare, Medicaid, and elderly waivered services under one program offered by 7 health plans across the state. So there's a care coordination benefit within our current MSHO model, and MSHO provider is required to develop a model of care that provides for the foundation of plan quality, care management, and care coordination. So some of the goals that are similar to the PACE program. Certainly both PACE and other fully integrated dual models have been shown to have lower rates of hospitalization and high enrollee satisfaction. Of note also is that Minnesota offers SNBC, which is a highly integrated dual special needs plan for people with disabilities ages 18 to 64. However, a key difference here is that the home and community-based services, or the waivered services and other HCBS services, are carved out of that benefit. So those are paid on a fee-for-service basis for people that are enrolled in SNBC. So I think one of the key differences, or one of the things that PACE would add to Minnesota's long-term care infrastructure, is it would be the only model in Minnesota that could coordinate an enrollee's Medicare, Medicaid, and long-term care or home and community-based services for people 55 to 64. So we don't currently have a fully integrated model, as I just mentioned, for people with disabilities that are under 65. So one key point is that there would be a new service option for people that are 55 to 64 that doesn't currently exist in Minnesota. Some national context here. There are 180 PACE organizations operating in 33 states and the District of Columbia. And for the whole nation, that is serving roughly just over 80,000 people. And then again, for kind of context and level setting, Minnesota has over 25,000 people enrolled in the Minnesota Senior Health Options. So that program of 65 and older that's integrated across elderly waiver. So I mentioned a couple different reports here, and I'll provide a very high-level summary. I had mentioned in terms of determining the capitation rates, we needed to do an actuarial analysis, and were asked to do that by the legislature. So Minnesota contracted with consulting firm Barry Dunn for an implementation analysis, and then Millman for the actuarial analysis. So two different things, kind of how to implement, what Minnesota should be considering if it were to authorize and implement PACE and fund it, and then the actuarial report, which is obviously a different discipline in terms of determining those capitation rates through looking at a lot of data. We did really try to work with external partners throughout this process, knowing that there is a lot of interest in PACE in Minnesota across different sectors. And so Barry Dunn held 3 sessions with interested parties in 23 and 24 to discuss planning for the reports, the release of the actuarial report, and we continue to be collaborative and meet with interested parties on this as things move forward. We shared a draft of the implementation analysis report with those interested parties in May of 24, shortly before the report was finalized. So just giving you kind of, you can see here, there are many, many different sections in the implementation analysis report. You can see some of those up on the screen. I'm going to spend some time talking about the PACE implementation considerations, some of the high-level themes from these various topics, but certainly invite you to take a look at that in more detail if that's of interest. So areas of consideration for Minnesota were we to implement and fund a PACE program here. certainly, you know, some of the key things here are determining how initial PACE organizations will be identified and selected, and any state-specific criteria that we would, you know, that from a public policy perspective, we would want to add. So the feds provide a blueprint for what a PACE program looks like in Minnesota, can add, if it chooses, additional considerations, focus areas, and things like that within the bounds of the federal requirements. So need to really think through what that looks like. And also need to think about from an implementation perspective, there might be people that are currently receiving services in MSHO that would want to move over to PACE, but there might be some that don't want to do that, that are happy with their services. So sort of one of the implementation concerns is being very thoughtful about that informed choice, making sure people understand what their options are, but they make a free choice between different service models, and then what that means in terms of enrollment, disenrollment, and sometimes people are involuntarily disenrolled for eligibility purposes. Talked a little bit about actuarial rate setting, and kind of that's obviously going to depend and be determined by the focus areas that we identify. And then similarly, the process for overseeing an organization's administration of PACE, including the critical incident management or adult protection issues and the safety, you know, if someone is really trying to make it in the community, but maybe we're concerned it's not safe, how do we work with the PACE provider? What do those criteria look like? What rights does the person have to determine those things? So those are all things we would need to think through at a policy level were we to implement and have funding for PACE. So even though the kind of model is approved and established at the federal level, states do still need to make a state plan amendment application. So we aren't creating this model from scratch. So certainly that makes it easier from a timeline perspective. But I think this slide just shows that it is not flipping a switch. We do need to work with the federal government to do sort of initial planning and approvals, get feedback from them, and then come back with our final plan. CMS will, you know, put states on the clock, quote unquote, in terms of, you know, you have to work with them on changes or adjustments to your plan within the certain time frames. Otherwise, if they feel like you're not ready, they might take you off the clock. And so I don't anticipate that being a major challenge here, but just to know that there is a federal approval process that we have to consider with implementation timelines and effective dates. So I think the best way to think about PACE is that it's a three-way agreement with CMS, the state, and the providers of PACE services. So there are requirements that these providers need to meet based on federal law, not just on state requirements. And we also need to conduct things like a readiness review before a new PACE organization can start providing services. Part of the federal model is that readiness review has to occur before services can consider. So again, none of this is like flipping a light switch, but it is a model that is known and understood. Other implementation considerations, we would need legislative authority and administrative resources to implement and pursue PACE. And again, depending on what kind of state-specific requirements we wanted to put in, that would also impact timelines. As well as the readiness of organizations that are interested in PACE. So, you know, whether an organization already has experience providing LTSS services and working with this population or not is going to greatly impact their ability to be ready and pass that readiness review. So current work underway, I had mentioned the implementation report and the actuarial report. We also released a request for information from potential PACE providers. That RFI closes at the end of this month. So you can see some of the things that we asked in the RFI, but this was really an additional effort we made to just gauge level of interest, the number of providers that are considering PACE, were it to be funded and authorized. So certainly when the RFI closes and the team has a chance to kind of run through results and analyze them, we are happy to provide summaries of RFI responses and kind of learn more about how that shapes potential implementation goals. And so that RFI really is kind of our first step in establishing, you know, kind of reestablishing that PACE program here. So happy to loop back on that once we have information to share. And with that, I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner, for your presentation. this morning. As we're collecting questions, I guess I can start today. First, you mentioned that an RFP was put out in 2011 and that there was no response. You weren't in this position in 2011, I don't believe. And so, but was there any discussion in this process about why there were no no proposals at that point?
Mr. Chair, members, my understanding from talking with folks that were here in that time is that the provider sentiment was that the capitation rate at that time was simply too low, that providers were concerned they couldn't make the money work.
Okay, thank you for that. As we look through this program as well, what is it, the basic 50-50 match with federal dollars, or is there a different match level for this if we were to invest in it?
Chair Schumacher, it's a 50-50 match. It's the standard FMAP for Medicaid.
Okay. You also mentioned in here the 12-month implementation. Some of the letters and feedback in the back of the report talk about an 18-month timeline to kind of stand up their programs. What would be the, if we were to approve it today or give you authorization today and the funding to go forward with this, does any of that timeline overlap, or are we looking for 18 months after the potential 12 months of the, while we wait for approval from the feds?
Mr. Chair, I think what I'd like to do is talk with the team and get back to you kind of on those overlapping timelines. I'm not fully sure. What I can say is that I think the RFI is giving us a jump start on some of the Minnesota specific implementation concerns. But what I'd like to get back to you on is how much a provider's readiness or organizations that have bid for it, how much that overlap can take place before. So we can get back to you on what that looks like.
Okay, thank you. My final question here is, I think staffing issues were discussed quite a bit in this report too. How, moving forward, how does that get addressed in these reports, or does that come in the RFI as well on how these things would be staffed, especially with the federal government making changes? I believe it was the changes to nursing home staffing that they was raising the most flags for this.
Chair Schumacher, I think no matter what model Minnesota uses, whether it's our MSHO model or it were to be PACE, I think staffing is going to continue to be a major challenge in our long-term services and supports, you know, marketplace, as it were, with changing demographics. I think one of the key differences in PACE from current service models is that geographical focus, right? So you have a PACE provider that is operating in a certain area of geography, and I think sometimes that is helpful in terms of being able to, advertise, to pull staff from a variety of disciplines and sort of bring more types of workers, whether those are clinical or direct support professionals, into that circle of support for a person. But I can't, I would be speculating if I said that would lead to better staffing outcomes. But I do think there are some things that are attractive to the model and I think innovative that help perhaps attract some workers, but I don't know that for sure.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for those answers there. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Mertz. My question has to do with just what you think the adoption rate would be for this program. You know, it looks like we have 25,000 MISO that are eligible, you know, that would probably meet all the recommended guidelines for it. What percent or how many people do you think would be taking advantage of this program if we had it?
Mr. Mertz.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Murphy, it is hard to say. I think that number very much depends on the number of applications for PACE providers that we have and, kind of where they're located geographically in terms of are they located in population centers or are they located more in rural areas, in which case, the number of adoptees will be dictated by that. I mean, I think I would point you to some national statistics that were in the slide deck where we have about, 180 PACE providers nationally that serve, I'm going to lose the number here.
80,000.
So with 25,000 people already enrolled in that dual integrated model here in Minnesota, I think it's hard to know exactly what the adaptation is or the adoption of it would be. But again, it is going to depend on the number of providers and where they're located.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the answer. You know, right now with the 180 PACE organizations and 80,000 members, that's about 600 people per, you know, PACE organization. So my next question is really, how many FTEs do you anticipate it will take to administer to a new PACE organization?
Commissioner Merz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I am going to call a friend on the fiscal analysis.
Welcome to the committee, friend. Please state your name for the record and help us answer Representative Murphy's question.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Rachel Shands. I'm the Deputy Director of the Aging and Adult Services Division at DHS within ADSA. And I have been working on this PACE report along with our colleagues in the healthcare administration and planning on potential PACE implementation. So we do know that we will need some additional staff at the department to stand up a new program such as PACE. We also know that there will be additional work for some of our existing staff to integrate PACE into our systems and processes and make sure we're ready to oversee contracts with PACE organizations and do quality oversight and reporting and all the different functions. So. We are working at DHS to finalize kind of an overall plan that we would be able to share within a fiscal note request for a bill that would potentially be introduced to implement PACE, and we would have more specifics at that time. But we do know we would definitely need additional staffing as well as, you know, some systems costs and that sort of thing to stand up a PACE program.
Representative Murphy.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Shands, for that. Just as kind of a, you know, ballpark, we're here just learning for the first time about PACE. As a ballpark, in past experiences, what would you anticipate an FTE, you know, asked to look like? You have any, I know it's not final, but I'm just kind of getting curious about learning all the numbers and kind of where you think things are at.
Director Shands.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I would ballpark 5 to 10, you know, somewhere in that range. Not a huge number, but if I had to ballpark today.
Yeah. Representative Murphy.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I think that's fair. I mean, it's hard to know the number exactly. My last question really is, how does the system PACE compare to nursing home placement in terms of cost? You know, can you give us some idea, you know, does it offset some of the cost for people, you know, maybe it's even availability, but how does it affect nursing home placement?
Who would like that one?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. So PACE in terms of costs, when we're looking at our overall actuarial analysis, I think it's going to be pretty similar to the costs that we pay right now under MSHO. Our MSHO program for people that are getting services in the community. So definitely less expensive than nursing home care. I think Minnesota as a state is in a different position than maybe some other states because we have this history of a fully integrated dual eligible model under MSHO. Other states who stand up a PACE program are you know, don't have the benefit of that history of integration. And so when they start offering PACE and that overall coordinated care, they really do see, you know, better outcomes for people and lower costs in terms of, you know, reducing unavoidable hospitalizations and nursing home placements. Minnesota has already done a lot of work in this space with our MSHO program. And so adding a PACE program is another great option. Minnesota probably will not see the types of additional savings from this program that other states might see just because of our current context.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you for that answer, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the answer, Ms. Shands, too. Just going back to kind of the ballpark, I mean, for me in rural Minnesota, I hear numbers of $12,000 to $18,000 a month for being in a nursing home. Give us a ballpark and where you think this number is, if there is, if you could?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have that number at my fingertips. I think we would need to go back to our colleagues at healthcare and take a closer look at that actuarial analysis. It did kind of give the actuarial analysis some idea of, you know, different cost levels for different groups of folks. It is very detailed, and if we were to stand up a PACE program, it would not be that complex. We would kind of work with our actuaries to roll that up into a more simplified number. So I apologize. I just don't think I'm the right person to give that number here today.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Yan, for that. And I won't hold you to the ballpark standard for this one. That's fine, but I would appreciate that those numbers sometimes just to be able to look at to see how it compares and if it's a really an option that really helps us, especially in the rural. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, Ned. Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. My question really quick is just talking in reference with Greater Minnesota, because that's who I represent. The implementation of this, do you think one of the main obstacles or only obstacles would be that there would be staffing issues to implement this program? Or do you see obstacles in Greater Minnesota that are bigger than staffing issues to roll this out in Greater Minnesota?
Commissioner Mers.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Gilman, I think it's hard to know what the obstacles are until you know where the organizations are and kind of what their scope and scale for providing things are. So it's a good question. It's a difficult one to provide a really straightforward answer. I do think that, you know, PACE isn't a silver bullet, again, against the other challenges we have in our long-term care services system. It certainly is a great option that has a proven track record. But I think things like access to transportation, particularly in Greater Minnesota, I know is really challenging for people. There are, again, if you live within that PACE geographical area, there might be additional transportation options through the adult day and the PACE provider. So I think some of those things get a little bit easier, assuming that you can find a provider that can create the staffing. I also think that in Greater Minnesota, you know, finding access to the licensed clinical components of the service model, PT, OT, you know, if you need RN services that are specialized, that can also be a challenge. But I think the benefit is you do have a network within that PACE provider to be able to try to maybe operate more creatively, more nimbly. And so it might help with some of that. But again, it's really difficult to predict the future. It's going to depend a lot on who wants to provide PACE and what capabilities they have in terms of number of people.
Representative Gilman.
So thank you, Chair. So one more follow-up on that. When I hear you talking about transportation, do you believe currently with the critical care access and different things that are challenging Greater Minnesota with transportation, do you believe the legislature and our committee here needs to look at the language around transportation? Would a fix with our transportation be able to help support a program like PACE?
Commissioner Mers.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Gilman, I think anything we can do to improve access to transportation has a benefit across multiple Medicaid and other types of programs for people.
Representative Gilman.
That answers my question. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Representative Gilman. Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. So when you come forward and part of the issue is you need to request more staffing, have you ever done a deep dive into checking to see whether there'd be any areas that are either, I'll say, outdated or antiquated where you could reduce staffing in order to offset the staffing that you're asking for?
Representative Jacobs, I don't, right at the moment, they're not asking for anything that would be in a proposal to move forward with this and maybe part of a bigger, more of the global discussion on DHS overall. But if the commissioner would like to or has any thoughts on that, Commissioner Mers?
Mr. Chair, Rep. Jacob, I think that's something we would look at through the process of requesting a fiscal note.
Okay. Well,
thank you. Representative, okay. Representative Backer.
Thank you, Chair. A couple questions here. What have you heard from providers in the recent rate study? Is it rates more competitive today, or you know, what are you hearing from providers?
Commissioner Merz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I will ask Ms. Shands to respond to that.
Director Shands.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we haven't honestly received, you know, feedback from providers that would indicate one way or the other whether they think it's, you know, the proposed rates are too high or too low. I think we had some questions just from them trying to understand the actuarial analysis and the rate setting process. So I think we will learn more about interest through the RFI process that, as Assistant Commissioner Merz said, is going to be closing at the end of this month. And we will continue to engage with providers and other interested parties on PACE as we move forward to try to answer questions about rate setting and other implementation issues. So,
Representative Becker.
Yeah, I would encourage that because this is very important. You know, I want to be very professional, but at the same time, this is your responsibility because obviously in greater Minnesota, we have these type of concerns. So if you could follow up on that and let me know because, you know, if it's cost prohibitive, because in light of the decline in nursing homes and, you know, the desires of folks to stay in place, wouldn't a PACE program be critical to assist a growing aging population?
Commissioner Merz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, again, certainly PACE is a tried and true option that's seen success across many, many nations or many, many states. I would, you know, certainly say that we also have success in our current MSHO program and that we need a wide variety of public policy strategies and solutions to meet the moment as our, you know, demographics are changing and we need to make public policy adjustments to meet that need.
Thank you. And yeah. Representative Becker.
You know, it does seem that PACE would save the state money, obviously, especially with our budget. So in light of that, that would, I mean, prevent of having additional health care costs to be incurred. Would you agree with that? Or
Commissioner Merz?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that question is better addressed through the fiscal note process and looking at that. It's really hard to speculate about savings in this moment.
Thank you. And Representative Becker, again, the focus of today was just on the report and the actuarial analysis. Once language gets produced and we have a bill that we can scrutinize a bit more, they'll have answers, better answers for us on some of these things, on just the direction. But from what I understand, the Department of Human Services doesn't have a position on this. They're just reporting what they've found, and so they're not advocating one way or the other. We're just, we need to advocate one way or the other.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Becker. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. So you've mentioned MNCHO, which is MNCHO, whatever. It's the one I'm more familiar with, and so I guess I'm a little confused when I looked through the report. What is the core difference between PACE and MNCHO? Like, what would be the differences?
Commissioner Merz?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, one key difference is that it would be available, a fully integrated model would be available for people 55 to 64. That is a core feature and a core difference. And I would ask Director Shands to provide any additional information on that.
Director Shands.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, in addition to the age criteria eligibility that the Assistant Commissioner Merz mentioned, another difference is kind of the site-based model that PACE has. It really is focused on a center, usually an adult day center, that's the focal point of PACE, and so it's bringing folks into that center with a lot of wraparound services, an interdisciplinary team, and it's really managed by the provider versus our MSHO program, which uses care coordination at a health plan level, and it's not site-specific. So I think those are kind of the, at a high level, a way to understand the differences.
Representative Hicks.
We mentioned that PACE would be 55 to 64. How does that work when the Medicare people aren't eligible for Medicare until 62. So are they on Medicare early because of disability, or does Medicare pay even if people aren't on Medicare? Medicare eligibility is 62. So if the program starts at 55, what's the gap funding from 55 to 62? Is it federal or is it state?
Director Shands.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks. So PACE is available to people who are dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid, or it can also be delivered to people who are on Medicaid only, in which case Medicaid is covering the full capitation. So there are some people who are on Medicare at an earlier age, in which case, you know, that would be PACE would integrate both their Medicare and Medicaid, or it can be just straight Medicaid.
Representative Hicks.
So to clarify, to qualify for Medicare prior to 62, you have to be certified disabled and you have to get through the 24-month wait unless you're on dialysis, right? So that's like the weird carve-out caveat, or dying, going to be dead in the next 6 months. Those are the only two ways to expedite a Medicare. So when you say it would be Medicaid in that space if they aren't Medicare eligible yet. So if they have, if they're in that 24-month wait, developed a disability at 55 in the 24-month wait, then it wouldn't be a more federal plan because they wouldn't have the Medicare. So it would be just straight Medicaid. So then it would be that 50-50, which is the exact same as our MNSHA, right?
Director Shands.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks. So if somebody is on Medicaid only, then yes, we are getting the services funded through Medicaid at our existing rate, and we don't have the Medicare benefit to then wrap around.
Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. Just if we get a fiscal for that, it would be really helpful if we could account for that difference, because that is a significant difference in state share during either the Medicare wait or if people aren't Medicare eligible yet. So really wanting to make sure that we highlight that in the fiscal.
Representative Hicks, Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I think according to Barry Dunn, there's no savings when you compare with the other states because we've got MSHA. How do you compare that when you add the administrative cost that will come with the PACE program?
Commissioner Mers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, you know, as you point out, because Minnesota already has a fully integrated dual plan, I think the benefit to PACE, understanding there would be need to be additional administrative resources to implement PACE, I think the benefit is kind of that unique site-based wraparound model for people. So I think the way I think about it is this alternative service model for people, does it add something, does it add an option that people want and need in Minnesota, in which case administrative resources to stand it up, you know, would likely make sense.
Representative Knorr.
You hit the second point that I had. It's a site-based, meaning that it's you're locked in a specific area. So another provider cannot be providing in that geographical area if there's an existing PACE program. Is that correct?
Commissioner Mers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, I would ask Director Shands to answer that if she knows.
Director Shands.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, I would need to take that back. I'm not sure exactly how states manage that within locations. I'm imagining it depends on kind of population density and how many people are, you know, eligible or likely to be served, but I'd need to take that question back.
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, thanks again. You mentioned Adult Day program as one of the sites that they can get those programs. Is the program requirement 55 and above, or is it 65 and above for the state of Minnesota?
Director Shands.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr. So if Minnesota does stand up a PACE program, we would follow the federal eligibility guidelines and make it available to people 55 plus.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this point, what is the adult day program requirement?
Shands. Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, I would need to probably defer that to our colleagues in Disability Services to answer that question on behalf of, I think you're asking, like, what age is adult day available under our disability waivers? And I don't have that answer. I think I would need to ask our colleagues in DSD.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we have a lot of questions because we want to make sure that we address it. And just wanted to know if we decide to move forward what timeline are we looking into? So let's say we approve right now, and then you go through the CMS process. When do you anticipate the implementation from the day that you start getting the authorization and everything else?
Commissioner Merz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, I mean, the kind of high-level timeline, again, is laid out in the slides with the federal government, but I think it's difficult to speculate on implementation without understanding the resources that might be allotted to it. So, right, like how fast we're able to go does often depend on the level of administrative resources and when we're able to kind of hit those timelines. So I do think that, you know, if a bill were brought forward and a fiscal note request were made, that then we could sort of say we could lay out some different scenario. We could lay out what we think it would take and what the timelines are. I think the other thing that this answer depends on too is whether Minnesota decides to do any state specific requirements, sort of add-ons to that program, and that can sometimes create complexity at the federal level. But I think more than anything, if we're going to add state specific criteria, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done with external parties to figure out what should those criteria be, or, you know, if given some direction from the legislature on that, then we can move forward with that. But often the implementation of how we would implement this particular type of criteria is going to take some extra effort and work.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the program scalable based on the research?
Commissioner Merz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, I would ask Director Shands if she has a response to that.
Director Shands.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, it is scalable in that, you know, states can decide how many PACE providers, PACE organizations a state wants to contract with. States could start small and then grow over time. I think the experience nationally shows that PACE programs are, in terms of an overall statewide population, PACE is going to serve a small percentage of folks that might be eligible, you know, that would be 55 plus and need a nursing home level of care and be eligible for Medicaid. So it is scalable, but I think just the nature of the program being site-based, it makes it, there's just kind of natural limits on the number of people that can be served.
Representative Norton.
My final question, since the RFI is closing on the 28th, is it possible just to share the interest from the providers so that we can just see what's out there?
Director Shands.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norr, certainly when we get responses, we can share a summary of just, you know, the numbers and some high level, summary of what we learned through that process. Absolutely.
Representative Norr.
Thank you. Mr. Chan, thank you to the director and assistant commissioner.
Quick follow-up, Representative Hicks.
I'm so sorry. I should have asked this before. Thank you, Chair. So since it's only Medicaid-eligible seniors, they would be subject to the spend down to utilize PACE and subject to the asset limit requirements of Medicaid, correct?
Director Shands.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, I think those are definitely some of the implementation issues that we need to work through with our healthcare eligibility folks. In general, it is going to be kind of a smoother process, and our goal to try to make eligibility similar across PACE and other Medicaid LTSS programs. So short answer, it would be similar.
So
Representative Hicks.
Chair, thank you. So my question is, I'm not sure about everybody else, but I have a lot of seniors that I talk to that aren't Medicaid eligible because they have to spend down to 100% of the federal poverty line and liquidate all of their assets to be Medicaid eligible. And so to be Medicaid eligible as a senior and remain in your home and utilize a program like PACE forces you into poverty. And as a reminder, we still, on the federal level, passed by Reagan and has never been repealed by either a Democrat or a Republican, to be fair, we still have Medicaid clawbacks upon death. So I have a lot of seniors in my district who are really afraid to go on Medicaid to utilize services like this or, frankly, any other services like nursing homes, Representative Murphy, because Medicaid forces them into poverty at the end of their life and leaves their families with nothing at the end. And so when we think about PACE, I need everybody to just be mindful that we're talking about Medicaid only, because my understanding is there is not a buy-in option for folks to utilize this service if they are not on Medicaid. Is that correct?
Director Shands.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, I apologize. I misspoke slightly in saying that it was only Medicaid. In the PACE model, I think there is actually a private pay buy-in option for folks. I think the experience nationally is that there's not a lot of folks that do that, and so most of the folks in PACE are on Medicaid, but it is possible to serve people who are private pay with a buy-in.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. Yeah, the reason I'm asking is because the buy-in piece is really important to me, because I know there's a lot of folks who don't want to go on Medicaid. And so do we know, will the fiscal include, I guess is a better question, will the fiscal include information about what that buy-in would look like for people potentially?
Director Shands.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, I don't know the answer to that right now. I need to take that back to our fiscal team.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I just really appreciate it, because I hear from so many seniors that are, frankly, avoiding the supports they need to stay in their home because they don't want to be forced into poverty of Medicaid. And so they're avoiding those services. They're relying on family. They're relying on other folks. And frankly, sometimes they're putting themselves in really poor health situations. So then when they do end up accessing care, it's in an emergency, after a significant fall, after a significant incident. And then they're in the more expensive care and requiring more support because they waited so long to access any supports. And so that buy-in piece is going to be really important for me to understand what that would look like for people, because if it's $12,000 a month, then it's not really a buy-in option that's going to work. And so we need to have that conversation. So thank you. And thank you for the extra time, Chair. I appreciate it.
Representative Hicks, Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Every question that's been asked has created another question in my mind. But to Rep. Hicks's questioning about cost mix within MSHO and within the PACE program. So if we look at, you know, how many folks would we transition maybe from MSHO into PACE, one of the deciding factors, or that would at least on our side motivate us to doing that, is if somewhere in that mix the state share was much smaller in one versus the other, right? So even if the total costs are similar, how does that mix lay out inside of that payment for that particular resident, that particular patient? Is there much of a difference in mix than in state cost between these two programs, depending on different scenarios?
Commissioner Merz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the match in PACE is the same match that we get in our MSHO program. So I would think that the cost, you know, the allocation of cost between state and federal government is similar across those two. But would ask Director Shands if I've gotten any of that wrong.
Director Shands.
Mr. Chair, nothing to add.
Representative Gander.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Next question for me is, and I was hearing it unfold. I had the question written early on, and then it was starting to unfold as we had this conversation. It sounds like in PACE, the negotiation is with provider groups. And it sounds like with MSHO, the negotiation is with the health plans, right? So that's a significant difference. That's a whole different negotiation. Over here you have health plans. They're totally used to all this, you know, underwriting, actuarial stuff. And over here you have provider groups that really don't have a clue. You know, how do I take a fixed dollar for this group of patients and provide all of these services? Would you please describe to me what those provider groups look like? Would it be someone who provides adult respite care that would plan to contract out with OT, PT, you know, all the other services inside that capitation rate? Or does it have to be a multidisciplinary provider group that has all those folks in-house? Or could it be either one of those groups?
Commissioner Merz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would ask Ms. Shands if she has an answer to that question.
Director Shands.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, probably some of the provider groups who are interested are better positioned to answer this question and kind of describe their organization and how they, you know, would operate and how they would envision doing this in Minnesota. But I think, you know, in general, the types of providers that would be interested and have the capacity to stand up a PACE model are organizations that have maybe done this in other states, or they have you know, a line of services already, adult day, assisted living, maybe nursing home, and then they add PACE with all of the wraparound services and create maybe subcontracts. That's kind of our understanding of one way to do it, but I'm sure the provider groups would be able to answer this in a lot more detail.
And extra points for the pun there, Director Shands. And Representative Gander, I think they have the RFI coming out next week, or with the deadline next week, we'll get more information on that as well for helpful. Representative Gander.
Thank you. And I know this is probably out there in everyone's mind, and to what degree are we going for cost containment here, and to what degree are we going for better coordination of care, right? Which of those are we really, I know you could say it's both, but really, what's the driving force behind this?
Commissioner Merz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gander, I do think that the quality of care and the wraparound supports and the sort of the geographical area are core drivers of why providers are very interested in this model. It is a smaller scale than our current MSHO program, as we've talked about before. So in my mind, I think it is more about how are we developing different service continuum options for people to avoid having to go into an institution setting as they age. It really is consistent with policies about aging in place and being in community. And so our MSHO program is focused on that as well, with quality and integrated and coordinated care. But I think, as we talked about, PACE being kind of another option on the menu that may really benefit people because of that fully integrated care and that geographic location focus.
Representative Gander.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. To what degree do we have latitude with regard to the capitation rate up to the max? In other words, at the state level, if we get no offers, no providers, you know, to what degree do we have flexibility on the capitation rate up to that max if we're committed to this program?
Commissioner Merz. Director Shams.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So I will attempt to answer on behalf of our colleagues in the Healthcare Administration, who really oversee the actuarial work and the rate setting. And I think they would say there are very specific rules around Medicaid rate setting and what we would be able to pay in a capitated model like this. So I think that would be our answer. There's pretty tight requirements and rules that we need to follow.
Representative Gander.
One final thing, and I don't think it's a question. I think I heard you say maybe that you wouldn't want there to be tight bands of acuity level as for setting rates within PACE. And I think you're going to want to preserve those fairly tight bands of acuity level with regard to the degree of need that that individual has, particularly if you're going into the private sector and trying to do maybe a private pay option. You know, if you have just broad bands, you're going to have to go to the highest rate. But if you keep them somewhat tight, you would create a product that someone could say, yeah, I want that more limited bit of service at that lower rate. So I wouldn't want you to go to just some broad rate with some high number and say, hey, do it for that. I think we're going to want to somehow preserve those tight bands to make it more appealing, especially to those who would be in the private pay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gander. Representative Hildesley.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you for being here today and presenting. And so going off of Representative Gander's line of questioning in regards to cost, and I'm thinking from a cost savings perspective, do you guys think that there is projected cost savings of PACE compared to like the traditional Medicaid, Medicare-funded long-term care?
Commissioner Merz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we know kind of looking nationally with fully integrated models that the savings or the costs tend to be pretty similar between a fully integrated model like MSHO and PACE, but it's really challenging to answer that question without going through the rigor of a fiscal analysis.
Okay. Representative Hildesley.
Thank you so much. I got one more question here. In regards to reimbursement rates, do you know if PACE reimbursement rates would be competitive enough to attract provider participation without increase in cost for the state? Do we know that?
Commissioner Merz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't know that for sure, but what I can say is I think the RFI results will give us a very strong indicator because the providers that are interested in PACE and have been, you know, bringing this forward for many years have been integral and given a lot of given some opportunities to provide feedback on the actuarial report, which really digs into kind of what those numbers might look like and what it looks like. So I think between the engagement that we've done with providers on these different actuarial reports and implementation concerns, we'll be able to get a really good sense of the level of interest with the RFI results that, as Director Schanz mentioned, we will certainly summarize and provide to this committee.
Representative Hiltzley.
And I'm sorry, one more. This is hopefully an easy one. What are the key metrics from your end would you guys look at and use to measure success for PACE in improving healthcare for our seniors? Thank you.
Commissioner Merz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I will give a high-level answer, and then we'll ask Director Schanz to fill in any gaps. I think the primary purpose of PACE is to prevent avoidable institutionalization, so avoidable hospitalizations, avoidable nursing facility placement, through this coordinated care model, right? The idea is if you're able to intervene, let's say, for example, someone is at risk of falls, which we know many seniors are, and sometimes those falls can be the first cascade in negative health outcomes and high levels of institutional care. So let's say, for example, that a person is identified of being at a risk of falls. Rather than waiting for a fall, going to the nursing home, and then getting OT and PT, I think the PACE provider would be able to identify that risk, and it would be both cost-effective and effective for the person in terms of quality of life to come out and have that PT or that OT assessment in terms of the physical environment, looking at what are the risks within the home that might be producing falls, rugs, ridges, lips of, you know, in the physical environment. And then on the PT side, maybe there is a regimen of strength training, other types of PT exercises to improve balance and coordination. So I think the idea is those services are available ahead when risks are identified versus waiting for that catastrophic situation that results in someone needing to go to the hospital and then accessing all those services for re. Director Schanz, anything else you'd like?
Director Schanz.
Mr. Chair, no, I don't have anything to add at this time.
Right. Representative Hilde. Final question, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner and Ms. Schanz. I appreciate Representative Hicks' comments. It was helpful. So there's the private buy-in. That's a little bit of a novel idea. But I have long-term care insurance. And my understanding is that long-term care insurance is not even offered by my provider anymore, my insurance company. But because of that, to help protect assets, and especially with what Representative Hicks commented as far as the risk of loss, and that's why we do it, to try to protect some assets. But that long-term care insurance, would it be eligible under this? Because I think that would be a way for people to grow their actual coverage or insurance if we partnered a little bit with them by making this an eligible expense or an eligible asset under the program, under the private buy-in. And I think more people would do it, and that would help people preserve their assets. So do you think that long-term care coverage would be something that could be part of the private opt-in?
Director Schanz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, so are you asking whether if people had long-term care insurance, they could use that benefit to pay for a PACE, like private pay option?
Representative Murphy.
Chair, yes, because I know sometimes they skirt around what you can actually use it for. And so it's kind of tricky. But if this was something that was up front, it would be helpful. So, yes.
Director Schanz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy. My understanding of long-term care insurance is, that the insurer kind of has their definition of, what kind of benefits would be covered. My immediate reaction would be, sure, this would be, a community benefit, providing the types of services that people need to remain at home. So I don't see why not. I'm also not a long-term care insurance expert, but it seems overall to fit the model of what LTC insurance would cover.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Director. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's great, but I think a clear understanding of that would be important so that we could definitely have that as an option, especially when it's been declining because we've been covering more people with Medicaid. So people have been opting out of that, and actually that would help the system out quite a bit. So I think it'd be nice to make sure that was clarified somewhere. That's an option. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. And we'll first, the committee thanks you for the presentation today and answering our robust questions. If any bills come forward or are introduced relating to PACE and we determine to hear it in this committee, then we'll continue this conversation this year. So thank you for that. And then we're ready for the Acute Care Transitions Advisory Council report. And members, we are looking to wrap up a little bit early today with the other events we have to take care of this morning. So we'll at the very least get through the report and the presentation this morning. So whenever you're ready, please present.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much for putting this on your agenda. I'm here to present the results of Acute Care Transitions Advisory Council report, and I am pleased to have the co-chair of that council, Mr. Berg, here, who will introduce himself and talk through the specific recommendations from the report. I also wanted, part of what I'm going to talk through today before I hand it off to Mr. Berg is work that's occurring right now in the Department of Human Services on complex transitions, so I'm trying to give you kind of a orientation to existing efforts as well as what the recommendations of the council are relative to solving for this very complex problem in our system. So the vision behind all the work that we are doing and will do in complex transitions is that people move through the care continuum and different levels of care based on what they need, that they sometimes do need to go to the hospital or might need intensive care in that setting, but that once that clinical need is resolved, they have a timely and high quality transition back to their home or community. Next slide, please. So this is a kind of a visual representation of that same vision. This was actually developed from the Acute Care Transitions Advisory Council, and it just really, again, stands for that visual representation that people are in community with their families, they're accessing critical care in community and acute care settings, and that they're moving across the continuum. Another thing that's really important in this space is using data to understand the scope and scale of the issue and the problem, and I'll talk a little bit about data needs and what our data has shown us so far. But I think a lot of this work right now, we hear really hard stories about people that have been stuck in hospitals for a really long time for a variety of reasons, and being able to solve for kind of a sustainable system that's going to reduce the likelihood of that happening should be informed by data. What are the effective interventions? What are the gaps in the system? And so you'll hear kind of reliance on collecting really high quality data over time, obviously disaggregated and with the right protections for people is going to be a really important part of a long-term solve for this issue. So the purpose of the Acute Care Transitions Advisory Council was to create an action plan that improves regional capacity for acute care transitions, looking at the different roles that counties, lead agencies, and tribal nations play. As you all know, we are a human services system that is state supervised and lead agency administered. And so we need to also make sure that we aren't creating complexity in the system that's not adding value. So by understanding whose responsibility is it to do what, and what does that look like in these really complex situations. Talked a little bit about creating a measurement and evaluation system. So again, that would be based on data collected statewide. And what was also important in the authorizing legislation was addressing geographic, racial, and ethnic disparities in how we think about designing a system that's more likely to result in people experiencing high quality transitions back to community after they need acute care. We know that a regional approach is very important because solutions that are available in population centers like the metro area or other larger cities aren't available in greater Minnesota, and we need to be attentive to the fact that we can't create one size fits all solutions. There might be things at a statewide level that would benefit this across the state, but we also know that to be really effective at helping people have better transitions, that regional approach where regions come together in a multidisciplinary way and really talk about what are our particular gaps in our region and how might we solve them with additional funding and resources, and that that information happens in that regional level and then is rolled up to the statewide level for actions that, that are appropriate on a state at a state basis. So just want to make a quick note, a point of comparison here. During the ravages of COVID, DHS along with MDH worked with nursing facility providers and home care providers to operate a program called Hospital Decompression. So this was an effort during the height of the pandemic where the emergency departments were very much at capacity. There were not open beds, and there was a very sincere and legitimate worry that people wouldn't be able to access hospital services writ large, right? They'd go to the hospital and they'd get turned away and sent to a different hospital because of bed capacity. So the hospital decompression during that time really was an effort to clear hospital beds as quickly as possible and have a coordinated system to get people that didn't absolutely need hospital level of care out of the hospital and into different types of levels of care to meet their needs. So I want to distinguish that effort that was very much driven by public health concerns and those things from this work and this report, which really is focused on the individual patient in the hospital or the person that's stuck in the hospital, and how we can create systems to help them have shorter stays when necessary, when a longer stay is not necessary, and that they're returning, that the discharge plan that they have from the hospital to community is thoughtful and includes, you know, kind of all the mixes we know that are important for long-term success and avoidance of rehospitalization. So the focus here of acute and complex transitions is a broader, more systemic approach versus hospital decompression, which was a very short-term effort needed related to COVID. So just to draw a distinction between those two things, the focus is different here in complex transitions. So before I walk through the reports or the recommendations, or ask Mr. Berg to walk through the recommendations from the council, I did want to just orient the committee to work that is occurring currently in DHS and my administration. So we, you know, post-COVID really understood that this was a very serious and significant problem that was impeding hospital access, but also people were experiencing really bad outcomes through being stuck in the hospital. So we used some federal grant dollars to stand up a team at DHS called the Complex Transitions Team that works with lead agencies, community-based providers, and hospital systems to try to effectuate more timely and safer and better discharges. So I did want to just make this committee available. It took us a while to get staffed up and kind of work through some of the things, but we are operating three regions right now. You can see the geographic breakdown there on the slide. And we have a online referral smart form that is available to lead agencies and hospitals to make referrals to the complex transitions team. And then we follow, you know, a certain protocol of gathering information and working with the lead agency. So we are actively receiving and acting on referrals currently. So just a note about kind of what this looks like today and eligibility. We don't have a super formal eligibility criteria, but as the state Medicaid agency, we need kind of a reason to receive information and work with someone. And so we would be looking at people that are either already on MA or very likely eligible for MA as our kind of touch point. What brings DHS into the mix? How can we be helpful? It's when that person has some connection or future connection to the medical assistance or system. We also ask that providers or hospitals wait at least a week before they make those referrals to us, just from a workload perspective. And then, so in that same vein, that they've already met their treatment objectives, right? That the idea is that they don't need hospital level of care and there isn't an option in the community, or someone is stuck, or they have an option in the community, but it's just taking a really long time to get all the services and supports lined up on the right timeline, and it's very complicated. So some things that we help with, we connect to clinical consultation and enhanced training for staff, for people in the community. Often people with complex needs come with a very wide variety of needs, and you need disciplines on behavioral health, complex medical care, other types of things, coordination and services. And so we can connect to some clinical consultation resources and help figure out how to get the direct care support staff and their supervisors additional training that might be necessary to do a good job supporting that person. We have been making efforts to build a referral network within the state of providers that have volunteered to say, hey, we know how to serve people with complex needs, and we want to work with you, DHS, to figure out how to do that better, how to expand capacity. And so we are working on that as we speak. We also think that connections to full and high-quality person-centered planning is really essential for people with it's good for everyone, but it's really essential for people with complex medical needs. And so we're also able to connect to person-centered planners that can then create plans and work with providers to create that. We have some limited amount of flexible grant funding that we can utilize. Again, sometimes what we're doing is helping a provider pay to train staff before they can actually bill Medicaid, or to make something go faster that Medicaid might cover, but it's just taking a long time. If we can, you know, do something in a flexible grant while we're waiting for the MA authorizations to come through, that is a value, we think. And then, you know, I'd mentioned before, sometimes with the complexities of people's needs, there's a lot of administrative coordination that needs to happen to get everything in place and for that person to go home. And sometimes that can be really, really challenging for hospitals or county case managers, because they need to work with, let's say, a county licensor on a new development or a new group home. They need a rate exception. They also need to make sure that the MIN Choices assessment is conducted in a timely manner, and the SMRT determination needs to occur, right? So you can see that there's many different touch points there in the Department of Human Services and the counties to make that happen. So one of the things we think about with the Complex Transitions team is we try to absorb some of that complexity for the lead agency or the provider, as it were. So we try to say, okay, the complex transition coordinator is your one point of contact. That person's going to go talk to the rate exception people. They're going to go talk to OIG licensing. They're going to go figure out what the answer is in the SMRT determination and come back and give that information. So it's just a point of coordination and alignment. And meanwhile, we are capturing data about barriers and challenges that help us understand the system solutions. So just wanted to give you some of our preliminary data. I always caveat that this data is not a complete look statewide. It's more complete, you know, than it was 3-4 months ago when we had some limitations on the number of referrals we could accept. But I would think about this as maybe a snapshot, an early indicator of what our trends are. I really do think that we don't have the full statewide data infrastructure that we need to be confident that we know all the barriers and issues and the most effective public policy interventions. But as you can see, referrals here, so since between November 23 and January 27, 25, we've received about 210 referrals for people 18 and older, and then 108 referrals for children under 18. And so certainly are working with the Department of Children, Youth, and Families when a child, someone under 18, is referred over to us to make sure that we're catching all the needed connections. So reason for referral, so why would people send referrals to the complex transitions team? You can see the breakdown there. But I think the key takeaway from this slide, I would look at the last two bars there, where really what's typically going on is there isn't a provider in the community that is equipped to meet that person's support needs. And because of that, they're sort of de facto stuck in the hospital. There's some reason they can't go back to the home from which they came to the hospital. And because of the complexity of needs, often, you know, we're talking about complex medical or people that have some complex behavioral health needs that show up in forms of aggression towards self or others. That is a key theme. So just would say that really it's capacity of the provider community for that person that typically is the barrier if we're rolling up to the most general way to think about this. Here you can just see some examples of length of hospitalization. And I know that for any of us that have spent time in the hospital, you do not want to be there longer than you need to, that you really poor outcomes, and those outcomes are exacerbated by the length of the unnecessary hospital stay. So support needs people experience. So kind of what does this population look like? Again, same caveats in terms of data and scope. But you can see that aggressive behavior is very much a theme that runs through, and people engage in aggressive behavior for a wide variety of reasons. And so it's very challenging to be able to point to that and say, if we did this, that would help, because it really is as diverse as the human experience. Illness or injury, aggressive behavior, symptoms of psychosis, active commitment, and SUD. So you can see kind of the breakdown here of the referrals that have come into us so far. And with that, I am going to, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, ask Mr. Berg to walk through the specific recommendations in the Acute Care Transitions Advisory Council report.
Thank you, Commissioner. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Berg. Please introduce yourself for the record and present your recommendations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Josh Berg, and as mentioned, I had the privilege of co-chairing the Advisory Council for about a year as we did our great work. And I would just very quickly, before I jump into that, double down and reinforce the work that Amy Peterson and Juanita St. Croix and those at the department that are already working in the complex transition team, the fantastic work that they're doing. They are tremendous resources already, and you know, I think this work in this report is looking to expand and give them even more resources. Just a very quick story. I was able to reach out to the team over the past couple weeks to actually take this a step further and try to prevent somebody from ending up in the hospital, who's going to get stuck in the hospital, that's going to be hard to get out of the hospital. So the long-term vision of this is to be even more proactive and preventative in all of this, so that we can keep people where they need to be with the services and supports that meet their needs and keep them from even getting stuck in the first place. So while this work is fantastic, I think this is just the beginning and we're scratching the surface. And kind of with that said, I guess I would say I was cynical slash I had tempered expectations of what an advisory council like this would do, having worked in state government and been on many advisory councils and boards throughout the years. You know, you kind of just wonder, is this going to be a report that sits on a shelf that collects dust and nobody does anything with it? And so went into it kind of with that mindset, unfortunately or fortunately, and I wasn't alone in that, but came out of the whole process really surprisingly energized and excited about where we could take this. And, you know, I think that's reflected in the great group of people that were a part of this. So we had folks from the Department of Ed, Health, Human Services. We had county attorney representation there with Brad Johnson up in Anoka County. We had the Minnesota Hospital Association, SEIU, tribal government, MAXA, mental health and subcommittee on children's mental health. So we had a whole slew of folks that cover so many pieces of the state and the services that we provide. So it was really just a fantastic group of people. We also, and I can't fail to mention this, we had folks with lived experience, maybe at the front and center. One of the gentlemen that participated from his hospital room with his transition relocation worker there supporting him to participate and be able to engage in this conversation, which was tremendously important and impactful and really kind of centered our work around him and the people that are actually stuck. So with all of that said, I apologize. I'll fly through these recommendations. And these start towards the middle to the end of the report. So depending on which version you're looking at, on the online version, it's on page 69. I think it also could be page 57. But you can skip a lot of the context if you want to get to the recommendations. The first recommendation, really due to the complexity of this work and everything that's surrounding it, you know, one thing that our group really emphasizes, we need to continue this advisory council in some sort of standing unit for some period of time. Now, you guys can debate how long that goes, if it's into perpetuity or sunsets at a certain point, but really there's a lot more work that needs to be done. Technically, we dissolved in October when the report was finished, so we no longer exist. So, you know, being able to continue this work, expand and support the work that's already being done by the Complex Transitions team is absolutely critical. It will continue to bring more stakeholders and more voices to the table, so we should and could get more individuals with lived experience across the state, even more representation, and then really work on how does this fit into the bigger system of DHS, and where does this council fit into that, and be able to support the work that's already being done. So that's basically recommendation number one. Recommendation number two really touches on some of the work that's already being done in the regional capacity and being able to expand that care navigation that's being done by the complex transitions team in the three regions. We had a lot of talk about how many regions should it be. Should it be based on judicial districts? Should it be based on some other already set regions in our state? So I think that work still needs to continue to kind of have those discussions. But the key thing is we have three functional regions right now. You can debate how functional, and if they could use more resources, they could be even more. But really learn from those three regional functioning pieces and expand that and look to incorporate it further into how it fits within DHS leadership and whatnot. So really expanding that and building on that regional capacity for care navigation. Recommendation number three really looked at the statewide infrastructure, the communication, the data sharing, all the agreements and pieces that would need to come into play with this. We had, you know, discussions about it, but we only had 9 meetings, so we were only able to dig deep enough to come up with this or these recommendations at a very high level. But really, we need to, as a state, have that infrastructure in place so that we can have the communication, the coordination of care amongst all the different stakeholders and be able to get the individuals that are at the center of this stuck, be able to coordinate their care and services in a more effective, more efficient, more streamlined way. Recommendation number four looks at the measurement and the systems that we have in place to really evaluate the outcomes and the work that's being done, specifically looking at some of those disparities across the state and making sure that we understand what are maybe some of those regional differences that, you know, it might look different down here in the metro than it does up in Duluth or down in southwest Minnesota, and what are some of those unique factors. And so really being able to track and to understand those, to be able to put some good action steps into place and really give the regional teams the ability to take that information and do something effective with it. And then lastly was kind of the other barriers and more maybe short-term, in more immediate policy changes that might exist right now. These could be administrative policies. These could be just things that are in our system right now that might be different levers that we could pull, maybe quicker, maybe less costly, maybe no cost. And this gets into examples of incentives or ways for providers to better support folks to get individuals out of hospitals and into their settings, looking at funding policies, supporting that transition process to get children and adults out of the hospital, and then some of the practices related to guardianship and just what is the complexity related to that. And then lastly, maybe some of the other ideas that you might hear in some legislative proposals or some discussions about min choice assessments and how can we streamline that process, some of the administrative pieces that I think we could provide some directions or guidance to the department on how they could do things maybe in a different way or consider doing them in a different way to remove barriers for folks and case managers and relocation workers and hospital folks to get people into services that they need in the community. So I will leave it at that, and if there's questions, happy to answer.
All right. Thank you for the presentation this morning on this report and the work that was done by the group to get us to this point for what we have. We have about, well, with no more than 10 minutes for questions, so we'll get started with Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief for this presentation. I just wanted to start by thanking the advisory group. I know we kept the agency busy last session. Quick question on the funding, the small funding that we provided to address the issues of the acute care transition, the complex care now. looking at that level, does it really fund the children and adults at the same time, or how is that program really working?
Commissioner Merz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, I'm not sure I'm fully tracking your question, but I think you're asking about how the breakdown between children and adults occurs, or maybe if you could clarify for
Representative
me.
Knorr.
Yes, and also the small funding that we provided in the last year when we were discussing about acute care transition. How is that really helping you do some of the complex care transition?
Commissioner Merz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, thank you for that question. So in terms of the funding, as you know, there were some administrative resources to operate the council. We contracted with the University of Minnesota Institute on Community Integration, and one of the reasons that we made that choice was that they have been working with the Disability Services Division in my administration for many, many years to expand positive support capacity in Minnesota. And what that means really is positive support practices share kind of core values of being person-centered, identifying strengths of people, really looking at what they can contribute to community, assuming that people can grow and learn. And so those positive support strategies can be a wide variety of modalities, but they're things like person-centered planning, trauma-informed support, high-fidelity wraparound supports, informational or motivational interviewing, excuse me. So I guess we're not to go too far afield from your question, but the part of the long-term solution I really believe for this problem in our system is continuing to expand and invest in provider training and lead agency training to be able to deliver a variety of positive supports, because those are ways to address aggressive behavior. So we talk about people with complex needs. Sometimes they're complaining about a lack of quality or a lack of service or a lack of options with their behavior when they haven't been listened to enough over years in our system and experience trauma because of that. So we really feel like if we overall expand positive support capacity in Minnesota through those investments, that lays a foundation that then allows us to layer on top of those basic positive support functions that all of us should, you know, deserve and receive when we're receiving services, but then we layer on clinical care and support and intensive person-centered planning. And when we have those things together, we have a provider that's confident and has capacity. We have resources for when a person is having maybe an escalating challenge or behavior, and we have access to clinical supports, and we have a team that takes a very, you know, a non-blame approach to trying to solve that problem, that is the very best model. The question is how to make sure we have enough providers and enough collaboration to produce that model for people that have these very complex needs. So the idea with the University of Minnesota is to say we've done a lot of work on kind of population-wide expanding access to positive supports. How do we build upon that infrastructure with these very specialized interventions that are necessary for people with complex needs? So that's a piece on kind of the administrative funding with the council and trying to build on past efforts to create that coherence in the system. We do operate that flexible grant funding called Transitions to Community Program, or the Whatever It Takes Fund. Some of you might know that term. So we did, you know, during the enhanced FMAP, get additional funding that is slowly running out in that that grant account. And we have utilized that, however, to be more nimble and pay for things, again, that maybe Medicaid might pay for, but it's going to take a long time to get there. And meanwhile, the person's stuck in the hospital. We've also utilized that fund, for example, to train receiving provider staff on the very individualized and specific needs of that person across their person-centered plan to what their clinical supports are. You know, when someone's in the hospital and the provider of the home and community-based services provider is maybe ready to accept them, they can't bill until that person walks across, you know, the threshold, as it were. And so it's really important to create high-quality transitions that the people that are going to be providing service have some engagement and involvement with the discharge plan from the hospital, and they start getting to know that person and building rapport and trust. But providers can't bill for that and often can't afford to just pay their staff to do that stuff without being able to bill Medicaid. So the flexible use of those grant funds has been very helpful to speed up transitions and create higher quality transitions. And then, you know, the third thing I would say that is in the council's recommendations in terms of new appropriations is we do think from the work we've done so far in regions that some flexible grant funding that's appropriated directly to that region or that, you know, lead agency within that region. I'm not, you know, we don't have a lot of detail on that, but if we could give regions access to some fairly modest state grant dollars so that they could have, they can take action when they identify a capacity need in their area to start doing something about that through utilizing of those funds. So I think that would be a wise investment as sort of like jumpstarting that collaboration, helping build capacity while we're looking at billing Medicaid for the long-term services and supports for that person for the duration of their life and community.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll follow up on some of the questions about the acute care transition. Thank you so much.
Representative Knorr, Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I guess my question or statement is just a little bit bigger than anything we're actually talking about here, because you keep referencing Greater Minnesota and some of the issue areas we have as the providers to provide what we need in Greater Minnesota. And so I want to start by saying, why do we lean in so much to just the U of M? And why are we not leaning into the Minnesota University systems? Those are the schools and institutions that are seen predominantly in Greater Minnesota. They're the more affordable ones. And have we broken down? We're always in silos. We always only work. And so many times today in other presentations, DHS says, we don't have the professional base in Greater Minnesota, yet we lean into the U of M for all of these efforts, which we know where most of that is based. And so are you talking to the Greater Minnesota schools to make sure that as they're making retrenchments in our schools, that we're not retrenching the programs that you're saying you need professionals in? Because what I fear is that we don't ever have those conversations. So our universities are trying to save money, and they're trying to retrench programs, and how are we making sure that we're not retrenching the professionals that we need that are creating these gap areas of providing the supports that we need? And so I guess that's two kind of questions. One, why do we lean so much into the U and not into the Greater Minnesota systems a little bit more? And then the second question is, do you communicate with those higher education institutions to let them know where we're seeing the lack of professional support and how we make sure we build a robust education system to have Minnesotans go to a Minnesota school to then work in Greater Minnesota? Because what's happening is it's our education systems that are moving our Greater Minnesota individuals who want to do this work to the cities to do work, and then they get stuck here. So I'm really loving to advocate for professionals being raised, trained, and then work in Greater Minnesota. So two questions, would love, if you don't have those answers, would love some follow-up on that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, and that will have to be our last question for the day. With your response, Commissioner Merz.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Keeler, I think you're absolutely right that there is untapped potential in our regional university systems. It's not something that we've explored so far relative to just this issue of acute and complex care transitions. But I think the vision of having a regional approach, and, you know, as we talked about, we have sort of three regions by default. There wasn't any specific, it was sort of just the resources that we had available through the federal grant that we got. So I think there are real opportunities, if we think about a regional approach and how to fund those approaches, to incorporate and include those university systems or those college systems or post-secondary education systems across Greater Minnesota to be a key strategy to start making sure we are developing the next generation of workers, whether those are direct support professionals or people that are skilled in behavioral health and clinical staff. So I appreciate that feedback.
All right. Thank you for this presentation today as well, for both presentations that we had today. And there is no further business that comes before us today. And so we get to come back tomorrow morning at 8:15. We'll see you all then. We are adjourned.